We've all heard of flyover country, that big stretch of America that separates the East Coast from the West Coast. In 2020, some of the nation's biggest headlines have come from this usually quiet region. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, armed militia at the Michigan State House, a foiled kidnapping plot of the Michigan governor. But as important as these stories are, coverage of how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the Midwest has been scarce. Hi, I'm Sarah Cooper. Welcome to COVID Between the Coasts. With research and data resources from the University of Evansville, bilingual reporters from CAPASA Midwest, and public media storytellers spread across seven Midwestern states, we are bringing you stories of how COVID-19 has impacted the lives and livelihoods of Midwesterners. These are the people we cover every day, and these are the pandemic stories you won't hear anywhere else. Thank you for listening. In episode 7, journalist June Loeffler takes a look at how neighboring states, populations, and even countries in the Midwest have navigated the pandemic and each other.
So I think even when certain areas were trying to be as cautious as they possibly could, they really couldn't impact what was going on just across the river, just across the border, and that just naturally seeped into their own community. I think I also found that, you know, say in Kentucky, you know, Governor Andy Beshear, he was very adamant about keeping the virus under control. And we really saw in the first 2-3 months that Kentucky was in a much better situation than Indiana, who might have been more lax and just was having more cases in the beginning. But now that's just changed. You know, even with the best intentions, clearly the virus is spreading between communities and still within communities.
On a Friday in September, Haley Edlin and Jenny Hockenberry are tying the knot in front of their family and friends in Louisville, Kentucky. After years of sharing mutual friends and some on-again, off-again dating, the couple finally settled into a home, started a family, and is getting married. But the timing wasn't exactly right if you consider the global pandemic. Bride Hockenberry planned around that reality on her wedding day.
You'll see right when you walk in, I mean, there's a sign that says love is infectious, but so is coronavirus.
Hockenberry and Edlin chose the date confidently at the end of 2019. The September wedding would mark 1 year since the couple got engaged. When Kentucky hunkered down in March, Hockenberry thought the height of the pandemic would be over by September. It would have to be.
We really thought things were going to be okay. Right, I guess everybody kind of thought that.
Eventually, Hockenberry realized it wouldn't be better. There were some options on the table, postponing or eloping. Neither felt right.
Both of us pretty much didn't enjoy planning a wedding as it was. And so we did not want to postpone. And plus, we both are of the thought that we don't know when this is going to be quote unquote over.
So the couple decided to keep the date. They asked all guests to wear masks at the ceremony and opted for outdoor seating for the reception. They even scaled down their guest list, which was a bit awkward since they already sent out save the date notices earlier in the year.
But then we sent out, we called it our like uninvitation, or we called it like you're on the B list.
She says the B listers were respectful. They knew the circumstances. But even for the guests Hockenberry was expecting, the A-listers, some weren't able to make the trip. And here is where we'll get into the topic we're focusing on for this episode. This topic spans further than Louisville, Kentucky, and impacts more than a wedding. Even though this country is the United States of America, the Midwest has lots of divisions. Between states, a Canadian border, and even borders with Native American tribal lands. So, Hockenberry had to plan a wedding around a pandemic, while guests coming from other states and Canada had to figure out how to get there without defined travel restrictions put in place.
And now to the coronavirus pandemic. Starting today, if you're traveling to Chicago from one of 15 states, you must quarantine for 2 weeks.
Chicago's Mayor Lori Lightfoot issued that order in July, just ahead of Independence Day celebrations. That law would apply to Bride Hockenberry's closest family, her parents living in a Chicago suburb and her brother in the city. However, Kentucky wasn't on that list of hotspot states in July or August. But September brought Kentucky's positivity rate to 10%, and Chicago took notice. Just 1 week before the wedding, Kentucky made the hot list.
If my parents weren't able to come, if my brother wasn't able to come, that would probably lead us to a discussion of, are we going to still really do this?
After months of planning, things were still up in the air. Now, like so many folks caught at the borderlines of COVID-19, she can't be certain about the days to come. Kentucky and Indiana are separated by the Ohio River. During the pandemic, this waterway has come to signify two different paths regarding COVID-19. At the end of April, Indiana's death toll was three times that of Kentucky's. Despite those numbers, Republican Governor Eric Holcomb chose May 1st to announce the reopening of Indiana retail and restaurants.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear says Indiana is reopening for business too early.
Let's not drive to other states just because they're doing something earlier if we think we have done it better.
Louisville business leaders called out how problematic the reopening plans were for Kentucky businesses. Greater Louisville Incorporated wrote to the governors asking them to get on the same page. Across the river, Wendy Dant Chesser is the director of One Southern Indiana Chamber of Commerce.
We would have loved for a federal policy to come in and tell us all, everybody's going to have the same guidelines and so forth.
But having worked in the bi-state area for decades, she admits she's accustomed to juggling two sets of standards, and she understands why.
We can't expect Governor Holcomb to make decisions in Indiana based on how it affects the Southern Indiana Louisville market when Gary, Indiana, is trying to figure out how to balance with what Chicago is doing. So, from Indianapolis's perspective, they have to do what's best for the whole state.
Municipal and state public health officials are in the same tug of war. Sarah Moyer is the public health director for Louisville Metro.
Yeah, I think it's all about collaboration and just those relationships. Contact tracing is not anything new for us, but it's just always been done on a much smaller scale, whether it's for HIV or tuberculosis or any other infectious disease. Now the problem is it's so massive, it's hard to keep up with collaboration when you have 14,000 cases in your jurisdiction. And I wish there was like a national public health registry database so our systems in Indiana and Kentucky could talk to each other. But like public health always does, we make the best of the resources we have and our collaborations.
The pandemic has brought both conflict and collaboration to neighboring states. But even within a single state, political leaders can't come up with a single vision. COVID-19 has been politicized across the country, especially in the state of Wisconsin. Democratic Governor Tony Evers issued a stay-at-home order in late March. Within 50 days, state Republicans challenged his order and the state Supreme Court overturned the mandate. Here is how Governor Evers talked about the ruling on cable news.
Do you think this decision is going to cost lives in your state?
Well, it's certainly not going to help. And frankly, it puts our state into chaos. There's no regulations out there right now.
Republicans felt the order wasn't legal and made the case that each county should make their own rules. The rest of the state shouldn't have to wait for urban areas like Milwaukee to cool down. This back-and-forth messaging has not affected all who live in Wisconsin. Within the tribal borders of the Oneida Nation, COVID-19 restrictions have been clear and undisputed.
The messaging to our community has been consistent on the importance of the safety precautions that each one of us has to follow in order to really have an impact on the spread of this virus.
That is Ravi Veer, the chief medical officer for the Oneida Nation. About 7,500 tribal members live in nearby counties or on the reservation, which spans 65,000 acres in the northeastern part of the state. The sovereign nation had declared a public health emergency and issued a stay-at-home order on March 12th. Unlike the Wisconsin state order, this order stayed in place, granted with some revisions. In late July, a mask mandate was issued, and that's still on the books as well.
Our challenge also is Native American communities have a lower life expectancy and have higher rates of health conditions like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure than the general population.
Dr. Veer says the tribe's autonomy has been critical for curbing the spread of the virus. Despite that, the tribe's caseload is actually higher than the state of Wisconsin, considering population numbers. The tribal nation's caseload is surging right in line with its closest neighbors. Dr. Veer knows the tribal reservation is not an island.
You can expand this further. What happens in Wisconsin affects our neighboring states, and what happens in our neighboring states affects Wisconsin. And the more we can be consistently following those safety precautions, I think as a nation, as the United States, I think we're going to be in a much better place sooner rather than later.
This is the sort of plea public health officials make on a daily basis. Despite our borders, we're all one country. But crossing into the international border with Canada, it's no longer about we. The border has been closed to non-essential traffic since March. The Canadian government hasn't wavered on this stance, and neither have the people. Robin Levinson King is an American reporting for the BBC out of Toronto.
There was a recent poll in September from Research Co., and they found that about 90% of Canadians want the border to stay closed, that most Canadians right now are worried it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse at home. It's going to get worse in the U.S.
There are a few key groups of people that are hurting from the closure. One would be tourism towns that rely on American visitors. Levinson King mentioned Niagara Falls as an example. Another would be border towns that essentially share residents, workers, and consumers.
Windsor, Ontario, which is right across the border from Detroit. These two cities were kind of like sister cities. People would live in one city and work in the other, and they would cross the border daily. It was really a very fluid situation, and that's, I think now, you know, it's kind of like having an arm chopped off.
These sorts of towns are so intertwined that personal relationships are caught up in the border restrictions. As a result, couples and families made pleas to the Canadian government. Finally, in October, familial exceptions were made for those such as siblings and grandparents. It also includes those who've dated for a year or longer. Back in Louisville, Kentucky, Jenny Hockenberry is just hours away from walking down the aisle. And despite the circumstances, her parents made it. Judy is Hockenberry's mother.
There was never a time when I thought I wouldn't come down for the wedding. We always had it in our mind that there was nothing. Come hell or high water, we were going to see our daughter married.
The two-week quarantine when they returned to Chicago was no trouble for her and her husband. Her employer understood. Even Hockenberry's grandparents, who are in their 80s, came down from the Chicago area.
Hi, Granny.
Hi, how are you?
You look beautiful. Your hair.
I had my own beautician.
I know you did.
While her grandparents are more at risk because of their ages, it's also why the stakes seem so high.
I was very clear with my grandparents about, you all do not have to do this, and it will be okay. I think part of the reason why they have really made the effort is I'm the first grandchild to get married, and they're getting up there.
Hockenberry's aunt, Karen Sue Narine, even flew in from Canada. She would have brought her whole family with her, four kids and her husband, but the border is closed for ground travel.
All my kids wrote notes to them and gave them their gift, you know, in a card, and said, you know, I wish we could be there, and I just can't believe that we can't be there, because they would have all come.
After the ceremony, as everyone headed outdoors for dancing and drinks, Sue Narine called me over. She wanted to show me something on her phone. It was a photo from her son. He's sitting in front of his TV, live streaming the ceremony, and decked out in a tux. It was a beautiful day for the whole family, those there and in spirit.
In episode 8, journalists from the University of Evansville share the ways COVID-19 has robbed Midwestern athletes of the futures they've worked for their whole lives.